All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're diving into a case, kind of a clash of the titans, really, where we've got Hollywood glamour and, the precise world of luxury watches.
Yeah, a little bit of a blank.
A little bit of bling, exactly. We're talking about the legal battle between Raymond Weil, the watchmaker, and Charlize Theron.
Oh, juicy.
It is juicy. And you know what? For all you law students out there, this one is particularly relevant because it really shines a light, no pun intended, on contract law, the nitty-gritty of
The
it.
stuff that makes or breaks deals.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly, we're zeroing in on those exclusivity clauses, those things that everyone kind of skims over, but they can really come back to bite you.
They can have some teeth, those clauses, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's where the drama really unfolded. Like, did Charlize wearing other brands actually breach the contract? And then, like, what happens when those contracts, those sacred agreements get broken? What are the consequences? What are the remedies? That's what we're digging into.
The big question really is all about that exclusivity clause. Like, that's the heart of this whole thing.
Okay, so let's set the stage here. Rewind back to 2005, Raymond Weil, they're ready to make a splash, right? They sign I mean, this is not chump change, a $3 million deal with Charlize Theron's production company.
Serious money.
Serious money, and the goal, she's going to be the face of their Shine watch collection throughout 2006.
Big campaign.
Huge campaign, right? But here's the kicker. That exclusivity clause, it wasn't just like a suggestion or a wink and a
Oh
nod.
no, it's legally
This
binding.
was like legally binding. She had to wear Raymond Weil watches, only those watches, whenever she was out in public.
Right.
And it wasn't even just watches, it was jewelry too. Like, she couldn't endorse or advertise anything else, even if it was for charity.
Wow, so they really wanted to lock that down, huh? Like, she's ours, no one else can even get a glimpse.
Absolutely. And it makes sense when you think about it, right? Brands, especially in this high-end luxury game, they're shelling out big bucks. They want that association to be crystal clear, untainted,
They're buying that exclusivity, that image, that connection with her. And they don't want any confusion in the market. They don't want someone thinking, oh, but wait, she's wearing a Dior watch. Maybe she likes that better.
Precisely. And that's exactly where the trouble started. Raymond Weil pointed to two big, well, they say breaches of contract. The first, and this is the one that really, got the legal wheels turning, was at South by Southwest, that big film festival, March 2006.
SXSW, yeah.
Yeah. And Charlize, she's there doing a press thing, and boom, she's photographed wearing, you guessed it, a Dior watch.
Oh boy, that's got to sting for Raymond Weil.
Right, talk about a slap in the face. And Dior, come on, they're like the big dog in the luxury market, direct competitor. But what made it even worse, those photos, they didn't just disappear into the ether. Dior used them in their own promotions.
Ouch. So now it's not just like an oops moment. It's deliberate. It's in their marketing materials. That's got to be a major problem for Raymond Weil.
Yeah, I mean, they're paying her to be the face of their brand, and she's out there front and center, basically giving a free ad to their rival. Not a good look. And then there was the second incident. This one involved a promotional poster for Montblanc.
Montblanc, yeah, the pens, right?
Yeah, famous for their pens, but they also have a watch line. And in this poster, Charlize was sporting a Montblanc necklace.
Okay, so Raymond Weil's argument is this is also violating the agreement.
Exactly. They're saying, hey, this is jewelry, falls under the contract, not cool.
Yeah.
And the court, they looked at these two incidents, and you know what? It gets really interesting because they had this very nuanced view.
It's not black and white, is it?
No, not at all. And it shows how these contracts, they have these like built-in ways of dealing with breaches without going nuclear right away.
Yeah, kind of like a safety valve, right?
Yeah.
A way to maybe work things out before it all explodes.
That's a great analogy. So we've got the scene set, the drama's unfolding. Now let's talk about what the court had to figure out, legally speaking. First off, did wearing that Dior watch and that Montblanc necklace, did that actually break the exclusivity clause? Straight up, yes or no?
The million-dollar question.
Right. And then if it did, what's the consequence? What's the legal remedy? You can't just break a contract and walk away scot-free. And then the third big thing, remember Raymond Weil? They didn't just say she broke the contract. They went further. They accused her of fraud.
Whoa, taking it up a notch.
Yeah, saying she never intended to honor the deal in the first place. So lots to unpack there. So let's start with that first question, the breach. When it came to the Dior watch, the court was pretty clear, like crystal clear. They said, look, the exclusivity clause, it was broad, it covered a lot, and showing up in public with a competitor's watch and the nail in the coffin, Dior using those photos, yeah, that's a violation, plain and simple.
No wiggle room there. Pretty
Right.
straightforward.
Right, but the Montblanc necklace, that's where it gets a little more nuanced. because the contract had this thing called a cure provision.
Okay, so this is like a chance to fix things, right?
Exactly. It's like a grace period. This provision gave Charlize 5 days to correct any, you know, potential breaches after Raymond Vile gave her a heads up.
So, like, if they catch it early enough, there's a chance to make it right.
Yeah, it's kind of like a whoops, my bad, let me fix that kind of thing. And in the case of the Mont Blanc poster, as soon as Raymond Vile raised the flag, bam, poster's down within that 5-day window, problem solved, or at least, you know, contained.
So it's like a built-in de-escalation tool.
That's exactly what it is. And it's super important in contract law. It's a way to avoid these big, messy legal fights if you can catch things early and fix them. But the Dior thing, that's where that cure provision couldn't really help, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those photos, once they're out there, they're out there. Dior's using them. Can't really put that genie back in the bottle within 5 days. The damage, so to speak, is done.
Yeah, like once that image is out there, it's associated, the exclusivity is kind of tainted. It's a different beast than just taking down a poster.
Okay, so we've established a breach happened, at least with the Dior watch. But remember, Raymond Vile, they went further. They said she committed fraud, that she never intended to honor the contract in the first place. What do you think about that?
Well, here's where we get into the nitty-gritty of legal definitions, right? Breach of contract, that's one thing. It means you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. But fraud, that's a whole different animal.
Yeah, it's not just a mistake. It's like intentional deception.
Exactly. To prove fraud, you got to show that the other party was deliberately trying to trick you from the very beginning when you signed the contract. You got to prove they had this hidden agenda, this plan to never fulfill their promise.
So it's not enough to just show they messed up later on. You got to go back to that moment of signing and show they were being sneaky.
Yeah, you got to prove they were being shady from the start. And the court, they looked at all the evidence and they basically said, look, we don't see it. We don't see enough to say Charlize signed this deal with the intention of wearing other brands.
And that's a key takeaway, right? A breach of contract doesn't automatically equal fraud. A breach could be an honest mistake, negligence, or even, you know, a change of heart later on. But fraud, that requires proving that initial malicious intent. So the court tossed out the fraud claim.
Yeah, and, you know, for you law students, that's a big lesson. The burden of proof is different. What you need to show the court is different for a breach versus fraud.
So we know there was a breach, at least with the Dior situation. No fraud. But now what? What happens? Raymond Vile wanted the whole contract thrown out. They wanted their $3 million back plus all their expenses.
They wanted to rewind? Like none of this has ever happened.
Right. A complete do-over. So did the court grant their wish?
Well, not quite. They weren't willing to go that far. They said, yeah, the Dior thing, that was a breach, no question. But they didn't undo the whole deal. And their reasoning is super important here.
Lay it on us.
They said, look, Raymond Vile, you got something out of this deal. You benefited. They had her for 18 months. She was associated with their brand. That's what they paid for, at least in part.
So the fact that Raymond Vile got something, a substantial part of what they bargained for, that played a big role in the court's decision not to just nuke the whole contract.
Absolutely. They basically said a material breach, which means a big failure to live up to the agreement, doesn't automatically mean you get to rip the whole thing up, especially if the other side has already gotten a decent chunk of what they were promised.
Makes sense. You can't just hit the undo button after you've already benefited from the deal.
Exactly. Rescission, which is what Raymond Vile wanted, that's usually reserved for those really major breaches, the ones that basically destroy the whole point of the contract in the first place. Like, imagine you hire a builder to build a house, and they only build one wall.
Yeah, that's not what you signed up for.
Right, that's a material breach. You could probably get out of that contract. But what if they build the whole house, but they forget to put in a doorknob? Still a breach, but maybe not one that justifies tearing the whole house down and starting over.
A doorknob, you can probably work that out, get some compensation or something.
Right, so the court is saying, look, Raymond Vile, you got most of what you wanted. The remedy should be about fixing the specific harm from the breach, not erasing the whole deal. So they denied rescission, but they didn't let Charlize off scot-free either. They said, okay, there was a breach. Raymond Vile's probably entitled to some damages, something to make up for the harm.
But here's the thing, right? How do you put a dollar amount on the damage caused by one photo of a celebrity wearing a competitor's watch? That seems almost impossible to calculate.
It's tricky, right? Especially with these big endorsement deals. It's not always about direct sales. It's about image association, these intangible things. But the court said, okay, even if it's hard to prove a specific financial loss, there's this concept of nominal damages.
Nominal damages? So that's not about like a huge payout?
No, it's more symbolic. Often it's just a dollar. But it's a way for the court to say, hey, you were wronged, your rights were violated, even if you can't prove you lost a ton of money because of it.
So even if Raymond Weil couldn't show exactly how much money they lost because of that Dior photo, they could still get this symbolic win, this acknowledgement that Charlize broke the agreement.
Exactly. It's a legal victory, even if it's not a financial windfall. So this case, it's a goldmine of contract law lessons. It's not just about celebrities and watches.
Let's recap those key takeaways, especially for our law student listeners who are, you know, soaking all this up.
All right. Lesson number one. Yeah. If you're writing an endorsement deal, especially with those exclusivity clauses, be crystal clear, no ambiguity, spell it out, what's allowed, what's not, what happens if someone steps out of line.
Lesson two. Those cure provisions, they're like gold. Include them, define them clearly. It gives everyone a chance to fix things before they escalate into a legal nightmare.
Lesson three, remember the different levels of proof, breach of contract, fraud. They're not the same. What you need to show the court is different.
Lesson four, nominal damages. Tuck that one away in your legal toolbox. Sometimes a symbolic win is still a win, even if the money's not pouring in.
And finally, remember that material breach, even a big one, doesn't mean the whole contract goes poof, especially if one side's already gotten a big chunk of what they bargained for. The remedy should fit the situation, you know.
Absolutely. And that's something to keep in mind with all contracts, not just these fancy celebrity ones. Sometimes it's about fixing the specific harm, not blowing the whole thing up. And as we saw, trying to figure out the exact damages in these celebrity cases with all their brand image stuff, that can be a real headache.
Yeah, it's not always as simple as just adding up the receipts.
So what happened in the end? Did they go to trial, dick it out in court?
Nope, they settled.
Classic Hollywood ending, huh?
Yeah, shortly after the court made their rulings, Raymond Weil and Charlize Theron, they reached a settlement agreement. Everything's hush-hush. We don't know the details.
So the financial outcome remains a mystery, but the legal lessons, those are clear as day. And that's what we're all about here on The Deep Dive.
Exactly. Because remember, even those seemingly small actions, they can have huge legal and financial consequences, especially when you're dealing with these big contracts.
It makes you think, right? What other situations are out there where the breach might be obvious, but figuring out the right legal solution is the real puzzle? It's like a real-life law school exam playing out in the world of luxury watches and Hollywood stars.
Food for thought, for sure.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, folks. We'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.